experience. As far as the community is concerned, I don't think I've ever felt so supported in my life. It's, you know, everyone was, you know, there for us, and you know, every person I saw, you know, had something to say to try to cheer me up.
That was the first part of an episode of Circle A Radio from 2001, recorded by Aaron Yankee, who is our current program director here at KABU. Thank you for listening to Totality of Circumstances. You can hear that and the second part of that episode on KBOO.FM. Give me about 10 minutes to put it on there. My name is Sam Bowman. Thank you for listening. You can hear this show again in 2 weeks' time. And just to give you a hint of where the second part of that is going, everybody was eventually cleared by a judge on September 10th, 2001. How the world has changed.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of I'm Afraid of Americans, a book release party on Saturday, June 8th from 6 to 7 p.m. at Books Around the Corner in Gresham. The stories of I'm Afraid of Americans are set in a high school in Los Angeles County in the 1980s. They show students, teachers, and support staff busy with daily details, but also living in the history, geography, and dislocations of their time. Author M.F. McAuliffe will read from the collection of stories and sign books. Again, that's I'm Afraid of Americans, a book release party on Saturday, June 8th from 6 to 7 p.m. at Books Around the Corner, 40 Northwest 2nd Street in Gresham. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KABU, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Transpositive PDX.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive PDX here on KBOO, Portland. My name is Jean Bryant. I use she and her pronouns. And co-hosting with me tonight is...
I'm Nicolette, and I use and/them pronouns.
We're honored tonight to have Drs. Jamison Green and Dan Karasik. They are both members of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, the WPATH as we most know it. They have been members of the WPATH for a number of years, both of them. They have quite a bit of history with it. Dr. Dan Karasik is a psychiatrist who works in the San Francisco Public Health Department and also teaches at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Jamison Green's doctorate is actually in law and jurisprudence. He's a specialist in legal language. This has been edited to fit our available broadcast time, but the full conversation is available in podcast at www.transpositive.wordpress.com. We're going to talk tonight about the WPATH in general, how it works, their processes in producing the standards of care that we as trans folks are subject to. Then we're going to get into a little bit about their path now towards producing what will be the Standards of Care version 8. Gentlemen, tell us some history about the WPATH. Where did it start? How did it get to where it is today?
Yeah, I'll just say that the history of transgender health precedes WPATH.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe, Jamison, you can start with wherever in that historical path you want to start.
I do a lot of presentations about this, and I often start with, you know, in the mid-1850s. But
perhaps just at the Harry Benjamin.
Well,
maybe so what, Harry Benjamin and post-World War II America might be a good place to start. And
while the university programs were going on, and even a little bit before that, doctors like Harry Benjamin, who was from Germany but had a practice in New York and San Francisco, he was into endocrinology. He was a medical doctor interested in endocrinology, in how hormones could help people stay young. And someone came to him early on and wanted estrogen. So Dr. Benjamin decided to see if this would help this person. And he gave them enough estrogen that they were able to grow small breasts, and that made them very happy, and they went on their way. So there you are, non-binary person right there. He worked with a lot of trans people, referring them to surgeons in Europe, because nobody in the United States was doing any kind of trans-related care. A number of doctors, including Dr. Benjamin, would get together and meet for a scientific symposium to share knowledge, and they did that periodically. A lot of that work was funded by a trans man named Reed Erickson. He was an independently wealthy gentleman who came from Texas oil money, and he used his money to help support research and information and education about the condition of being transsexual, was the language of the time. So he supported Harry Benjamin's work, and he supported these conferences. He was their fiscal sponsor, basically. When Johns Hopkins shut down, those doctors recognized that this was going to be a problem, that this was going to delegitimize all of this care and all of this work and research that they'd been doing, and cut off all of the patients that they had been working with. So a handful of doctors formed the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association in order to continue to have meetings and share knowledge. And that's essentially what they did for many, many years. The first standard of care was 2 pages. It was mostly about how surgeons needed to not overcharge their trans patients and, you know, things like that. Uh-huh. It was very, very basic. The next one was in 1979. In 1980, there was a reissue. It just corrected a few typos. In 1981 or 82, there was another one that was a little bit more involved. And then it progressed until 97 was version 5. Or excuse me, it was 98 when version 5 came out. It was 97 when they were working on it. And that was my first contact with HBGDA. Basically, I was appointed at that time to advise the Standards of Care Committee on inclusion of trans men's issues, which they ignored my 12-page paper completely. And
The trans women are all, you know, I don't know, media, everything, yeah.
Right, trans men are invisible.
Yeah.
When they came out with version 6 in 2001, there had been a couple of trans-identified people with academic credentials and medical credentials who asked for my 12-page paper and took it into the meeting and got nearly every change that I had asked for in version 5 into version 6. Of course, my name is associated as an advisor with version 5, but it was version 6 where those suggestions actually took place. And then I kept asking, can I be on the standards committee? Can I be on the standards committee? Because I love policy and I love, you know, I think these things need to be more clearly expressed. And one of the leaders of the organization said, well, you know, we don't need to revise the standards all the time because, you know, if anybody has a problem, they write me a letter and I write a letter back and I explain it. And I said, the fact that you have to write a letter to explain it is a problem. This stuff needs to be clear and you need to have thought of these things. And, you know, he wouldn't let me be on the standards committee until almost toward the end of the work that was going on for version 7. And then he asked me specifically to be on the committee and to be one of the main writers, because by that time I had proven myself as a real contributor. And I should say that the reason that I wasn't allowed to be a member was because they were debating because I wasn't a
You're
clinician.
Not medical, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't a clinician. So, you know, can we allow that? Well, I was only allowed to be a member in 2002. And then in 2003, I was nominated to the board. So from 2003 until 2018, I've been on the board. And I was reelected in 2007 and then elected president in 2011. And, you know, it isn't that it's all about me, but my experience mirrors, to a certain extent, the rising influence of trans people within the organization. Not just me, but many, many trans people are now very active in the organization. And that has all helped to change what we've been able to accomplish.
I think that's a very big piece to point to, that for decades, literally, the SOC was effectively written by cishet.
Not
know,
that they weren't
men.
Supporters.
Yeah.
They were.
Yeah.
But they had only their limited knowledge.
Right.
And none of them were writers, I can tell you that right now.
Yeah. Jamison, at the forming of WPAT, to say that there is a not always knowledge that gatekeeping, for which WPAT was notorious, was not initiated by WPAT, but really was a product of the very first gender programs.
Stanford and Johns Hopkins.
Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, Johns Hopkins.
Stanford sort of continued it, yeah.
And there actually were, in the 1960s and 70s, dozens of academic hospitals, academic medical centers that were providing trans care that had quite rigid gatekeeping because conceptions of what was necessary to successfully transition, or what a transgender person was, very binary, heteronormative assumptions that would take people with that thought with the best success of binary transition and blending into American society, associating heterosexual, you know, a standing citizen. The rigidity of these programs excluded a lot of people. And so there was a history of gatekeeping that preceded WPAP, but that WPAP ended up taking on as funding was cut off for diversity programs by Department of Health and Human Services in 1981, and WPAP stands for Care in 1979. So there was kind of a transition period where the standard bearer of trans care in the U.S. became people and individual practices who were united by WPAP and kind of adopted and adapted the gatekeeping already established in the very first gender program.
Yeah, I think actually part of that adoption was basically, I think they were trying to legitimize the field. They were trying to give it some validity within systems that were extremely resistant. And also, I think a lot of the early models came to a certain extent because of the language that we generally on the widely understood about gender and sex, which was extremely limited in those days. And also, there was there were the limitations that the trans people themselves had in trying to communicate about what they were experiencing and how they felt. That, you know, as a trans person myself, I can say with authority that this is a community in search of a language and has been for hundreds of years.
Yeah, that term gatekeeping, I appreciate you talking about that, Dan. Its origins are quite different than what most folks understand gatekeeping to be these days. It's almost like we really have to do a redefinition of that term.
Well, and it's true also that people misunderstand the standards of care as a gatekeeping tool, and they are not. They're pretty open-ended. They require that treatment be individualized, and even though there are guidelines set up for certain kinds of, you know, waiting periods, if you will, like they like you to be on hormones for a year before surgery, if the conditions for that patient are different and don't allow for that, or if that isn't necessarily needed, that can be waived. All it needs to happen is that it's documented.
Uh-huh.
There's no real hard and fast rule that can't be circumvented if you have a good reason.
So we're talking about the rigidity of gates and why it's going to happen in systems. And the other bit of history is that there were some competing ideas on trans care in the U.S. outside of WPATH. And
yes,
you know, I mentioned starting in 1993 at the Tom Waddell Health Center,
yep.
The informed consent model for hormones took hold and then got adopted by urban health centers across the U.S. over the ensuing years. And that idea that, particularly for hormones, that people shouldn't necessarily, you know, need to see a mental health care provider, you know, finally got adopted in Centers for Care 7 in 2011, but it had already been for almost 20 years common practice, yep. in San Francisco. And I even wrote an editorial in 2000 in a journal criticizing Standards of Care 5 for its gatekeeping and hormones. There was a, you know, all along there was pressure from the trans community and also trans health providers, especially in the United States, to, you know, to continue making progress. And that did include involving more trans people in the writing of care, as well as adopting some of the more progressive practices that had, you know, become commonplace in the United States specifically in those ensuing years.
Yeah, and that's so, absolutely true.
And at Standards of Care 8, I think there really has been an embracing of, you know, of all of those models, you know, and
yeah.
that they're not in opposition to each other. They're more just more data, you know, more
right.
Understanding of experiences and providing care. And
exactly.
So I really think that has moved in a great direction.
Yeah, there's a synergy starting to happen there,
right.
yes.
Right.
And Standards of Care 8, it's something like a third of the people on the committees are trans. It's a very large number.
Yes.
I know on my chapter that I'm leading, I think we have three trans people of seven. And there are some chapters, I think, that are, you know, all or almost all trans folks on them. And there's so many more trans people now who have become physicians.
Yes,
exactly.
Right.
Workers, psychologists, so many more in practice now,
yep.
than there were, you know, when Standards of Care 5
yes.
was being formulated.
Yeah.
We used to be between 200, 300, 400 members. Now we've got close to 2,500 members globally.
Oh my goodness.
And, you know, we're just trying to make a difference and improve practice for clinicians and improve care for patients and clients. And we've been able to accomplish a whole lot in spite of being perceived as the villains many times.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a labor of love for everyone.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome, and it's been an honor and a pleasure to do it.
Yeah, so it's my understanding, gentlemen, that it's actually here in the United States, it's the insurance companies that have
yeah.
rendered these guidelines, which is really what SOC is, that allow professional discretion
mm-hmm.
And judgment. The insurance companies aren't reading it that way, and they're using these as hard and fast rules to really... I don't know exactly what it is they're trying to accomplish.
Well, there are two things yeah. they're trying to accomplish. On one hand, they're trying to save money, always save money. And on the other hand, I think there are people, this is total conjecture on my part, I think there are people within insurance companies who want to prevent trans people from receiving care.
Of course.
I believe that as well, yes. The evolution that has happened in the last, 15 years or so is just astounding. I would have never guessed would be where we are today.
And the work on the insurance exclusions, that I started that in 1994 in San Francisco. And it took us until 2001 to get an exclusion removed in a city plan for city and county employees so that we could prove that this wasn't going to drive
gonna the break
city
the
to,
bank.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
Yes.
And then it took until 2006 for us to get actual data. And then we used the Corporate Equality Index through the Human Rights Campaign Foundation and their workplace project to move corporations to start demanding that their insurance mm-hmm. carriers remove the exclusions. That was a huge, long-term project that I worked on with a colleague, Andre Wilson, separate from WPATH. It had nothing to do with WPATH. It was strictly because of this need that we saw, and then I saw an opportunity when we got our non-discrimination ordinance passed. I said, guess what? Now you're in violation of your equal benefits ordinance. Uh-huh. And I remember the equal benefits ordinance in San Francisco was what moved domestic partners insurance across the country. Mm-hmm. And they went, what? How can we be in violation? I said, well, you have trans employees who aren't able to access their health benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Said, oh my God.
Yeah.
He said, let me help you with that.
It was amazing. Once there were, oh gosh, I don't know, a small handful of case law determinations
yes.
really started to shift everything. And unfortunately, some of those decisions were influenced by policy and executive order, which, you know, the new pharaoh has ordered those chiseled off the monument.
Right, I know.
So, you know, it's going to be fascinating to see what, if anything, happens
right.
in terms
scary,
of
yeah.
practice of law. Yeah.
yeah. And the other thing is, with respect to law, I mean, WPATH's policies, the fact that the standards of care exist and the policy statements that we've been putting out since our first medical necessity statement in 2008 have been game changers in the courts. Big mm-hmm. game changers.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about gatekeeping, and I do think that as people who are involved in creating standards of care, we have to be thinking ahead to the ways that people might misuse them as well, and to make sure people who are seeking care can find text within standards of care to appeal insurance denials in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Transpositive PDX on KBOO Portland. This is your host, Jean Bryant. We are speaking with Drs. Dan Karasik and Jamison Green from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. The WPATH is the organization that creates the international guidelines for transgender health. Gentlemen, back to the ideas of the gatekeeping. Because these were university programs, it's my assumption that they were set up with a research element. And so it's also my assumption that that's part of the reason why the participants in the program were screened for certain characteristics so that they had some statistical validity or
right.
However that goes in research, in mm-hmm. medical research.
Yeah, you definitely want to have a cohort that sort of hangs together so you don't have outliers who mess up your results
yeah.
and that sort of thing. So,
yeah.
It remained true. If you look at the diverse path of trans care in the United States versus in Canada and Europe, which is that care in the U.S. at the same time as getting upfold and the universities became less involved and most care went to private practice offices, when that happened, there also became a greater degree of flexibility that you don't see as much in the centralized gender programs outside of the U.S.
Right.
Over that preceding period of time. And so what happens is that you can have the resources of a government bureaucracy or university bureaucracy that can be helpful in providing care, but it also comes with strings and with rules And sometimes that is to further research. Sometimes it's to make sure that everyone's on board in that particular institution to provide them that care, because providing transgender care has been controversial in institutions. And so there was kind of a two-edged sword where in the U.S., even though a lot of people were denied care because there was no funding, there was also the ability of individual practitioners to be more flexible than they were, I think, under the academic programs, before 1981 in the U.S. and, continuing on after that in other countries.
Mm-hmm. By forcing all of the providers to be in private practice and not be working through institutions, basically we've established a system that says, if you can afford it, you can have it, whatever you want. But if you want to have insurance cover it, you have to play by their rules.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I suppose in a lot of ways, this is not unique to trans healthcare. Trans healthcare is playing out in front of this backdrop of just the whole system in the United States.
Yes.
Yeah. Even before you get to, the institutional prejudice against trans people, you have an institutional prejudice against medical care for people who need it in this country, which is that insurance companies are always battling paying claims, and insurance is always excluding coverage when obviously you should be providing that coverage. And a very dysfunctional healthcare system and dysfunctional insurance payment system. Then with this history of from 1981 until 2014. Of the federal government giving permission basically for healthcare exclusions for trans care as experimental. And this history then through those decades of most insurance policies specifically excluding trans care. And so you have that additional burden on top of the general dysfunction of our healthcare system and lack in certainly in many states of anyone in the system that's actually looking out for the patient, particularly the trans patient. Yeah. The Obama administration had tried to remove those trans health exclusions nationwide, which got stopped by a judge in Texas just after Trump was elected and remains frozen.
We're privileged to be here on the West Coast.
Yes.
Because, Washington, Oregon, and California, states govern an awful lot of the insurance stuff. And earlier, Dr. Green was observing that we have a lot better research than we've had.
Research.
We have more research.
More data.
More data now.
That shows that this treatment is effective.
Yes. And so with the advent of state and Medicaid-sponsored insurance coverages for trans healthcare procedures here, on the West Coast, what is the WPATH observing in terms of shifts with this increase of patients getting services? What's that telling us?
Well, one thing is that we need more providers who are knowledgeable. As more and more people are able to access care, there's more and more demand for the care, and we don't have enough surgeons. We don't have enough primary care people who are really educated on trans health. We are getting more and more all the time, but that's the number one thing that we see as we increase access to care.
Ultimately, the answer might come in the fact that trans care is moving back into academic centers. Like Oregon Health Sciences University has a big program, and UCSF does, because that allows a mainstreaming of training of new doctors.
That's right.
In trans care. And with the removal of insurance exclusions, academic medical centers were able to re-enter trans care. And I think that's allowing a lot more people, at least at certain universities, to get exposed to providing trans-specific care. And they're going to be able to go out into their careers as young doctors as comfortable providing that care as they're providing and yet for which they're trained. And so I think that is a very positive thing that's in our future.
Yeah, and some of the demand for that care or that training in medical schools is coming from medical students themselves who are not trans. And that's part of the very exciting evolution that's occurring with respect to understanding about gender diversity and gender variance. And
You're listening to Transpositive PDX on KBOO Portland. This is Jean Bryant. We are speaking with Drs. Dan Karasik and Jameson Green from the WPATH. The WPATH is the organization that creates the international guidelines for transgender health. And we've been speaking about the history. This next piece is about their current process for creating a new standards of care, version 8. So Dan, in that Friday pre-conference, you spoke kind of confidentially about some conjecture around the what might come out for SOC 8.
Oh, so now you want us to put it on the radio?
Well, that's why I'm putting this out front. I understand that you're going to be speaking in terms of process and some possibilities, maybe probabilities.
I have to say that one little disadvantage of our doing this now is that all of us don't know all of what every other of the 20 chapters has been writing. And it's not until we get to the Delphi process, which is the kind of consensus building process, that everyone will be familiar with everything. So we can talk about our work, but we can't really talk about SOC 8 as a whole. I mean, we can't say what is SOC 8 is going to be because it doesn't exist yet.
Right.
What exists is the work that each work group has done so far and the process that will lead us to getting SOC 8.
Yeah.
It's a lot more involved this time around than it was when we did SOC 7. Which got released in 2011. And that, I was on the core writing group. There were only 9 of us, and we did everything. But people like Dan as specialists and various other specialists worked on the primary documents. And then we took it and massaged it into one voice. Mm-hmm. This process is very different.
Okay, so there's been a shift in the WPATH's process.
Yeah, a little bit.
Uh-huh.
It's much more involved. It's more, there's more evidence now, more scientific evidence than there was in the 5 years that we worked on SOC 7. And now there's a lot more evidence. There's a lot more to be documented. There are points of debate that are kind of intense in some areas. So we don't know what is going to ultimately be decided.
One big difference between SOC 7, Standards of Care 7, and Standards of Care 8 is that there were only 34 of us total. Jameson was saying 9 in the writing group, but 34 of us total who authored Standards of Care 7. And there are
over 100
authors of Standards of Care 8. And so with Standards of Care 7, after there was a document, everyone was, the 34 of us could each read the document, comment on a Google document about it. And then we had phone calls where half of the 34 of us kind of time and debate the places where there was disagreement to reach consensus.
Yep.
We can't do that with this large of a group. And so there's a different process that will go on because ultimately the standards of care is a consensus document, and so it's something that the experts as a whole need to be able to stand behind. That's really the power of the document.
Are non-binary people also being considered in the standards of care?
Standards of Care 7 make clear that transition is not necessarily a binary process. There is a focus in Centers of Care 7 on dysphoria, relief of distress through medical and surgical treatment. And that can happen any starting point to any ending point. Centers of Care 8 is having a separate chapter on care for non-binary people. And so I think there will even be more advice and more consensus about care of non-binary people in Centers of Care 8 here. And there's a separate work group that is working on the standards for non-binary care.
Okay.
Let's talk about the mental health side of this, because, I mean, getting your letters, you got to have the letters. You know, most folks in our community who are on a trajectory for a medical transition, that's a hot topic. Do you see any shifts in terms of what the SOC verbiage might be around those guidelines?
Well, first, Standards of Care 7 has the informed consent model, which has been really a predominant model in San Francisco's public health programs since the early 90s, that got mainstream through Standards of Care 7 as an alternative to a letter for hormones. And I think more and more through even private practice physicians through the country, more and more of them are comfortable prescribing hormones without a mental health letter. I'm on the Managing Mental Health Conditions chapter of SOC8. I'm the chapter lead for that chapter, but I'm not on the assessments chapter. I think soon I'll see that, but I know that there's considerable sentiment for reducing the burden of two letters for surgery. We'll have to see where things land. That's going to be part of a consensus process. You know, that has to include our European colleagues who have more regimented gender programs. So we'll see where all of them land. I think that, ultimately, that there's a movement towards increasing accessibility to trans care, and part of that is just examining the burdens of gatekeeping and trying to lessen those. Even in terms of the gatekeeping aspect, the emphasis is not on turning people away from surgery, but when working with people who have, let's say, severe mental illness or substance use problems, on helping people to get those problems addressed so that they can get through the perioperative process with better outcomes, as opposed to excluding those folks from getting from care.
Mm-hmm. So a little more emphasis on that education and support element, as opposed to a simple assessment of comorbidities.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask, I personally am studying to be a social worker. So does WPATH do any work in the social work field as well?
Well, we have a lot of members who are social workers who work with trans populations, but we don't do work in the social work field per se. We encourage our social work members to be active on committees and provide that social work perspective to the interdisciplinary discussions that go on to form the consensus that ultimately leads to changes in the standards of care. So I think the perspective of social workers being much more politically engaged, if you will, I think lend a lot to what we can accomplish within WPATH. So the more the merrier.
Yeah, I would say, when Jameson says, well, WPATH doesn't provide social work, WPATH doesn't provide surgery. Or
yeah, we don't do anything like that.
All right.
we're not direct service providers, but we have members in each of those disciplines, and we are trying to represent and engage our membership in each of those disciplines. And I think that social workers have become a more important part of our membership and constituency, a larger part with the expansion of trans care in the last several years, but many of the people who have been part of WPATH's education and certification program have been social workers who are providing mental health care for trans folks. And I think, particularly in the United States, where many of our social work members are from, that I think the future really is with more of a voice from people who are doing that work.
Yeah, we started our global education initiative when I was president, and social work concepts and social workers as trainers are a big part of that program.
All right, thank you.
Actually, this topic kind of hooks back to what we were talking about earlier with the insurance coverages, in that the mental health side is, I mean, even Cadillac insurance really doesn't deal very well in this country with mental health. So it's a huge economic barrier for our population.
In terms of, are you speaking to the fact that the people think that therapy is a requirement for transition?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. A lot of providers, even within the West Coast states, still really are not inclined to give assessments without having quite a bit of contact time with a patient. A lot of visits.
In addition, there's just the general need for mental health care that is affecting both cis people and trans people.
Agreed. It's back to that backdrop of...
Unfortunately, the insurance coverage is so challenging for mental health care professionals that most people in private practice, or many people in private practice, just don't accept insurance because bureaucracy of it is
onerous.
Very challenging.
Yes.
And so many mental health care providers feel comfortable providing that care. Many of them don't accept insurance, and so people have to pay out of pocket and then get an out-of-network reimbursement, if they're lucky, from their insurance company.
Right, yeah.
It's a measure of the dysfunction of our healthcare system generally that spills over to the trans folks who do need mental health care, whether they just need a mental health assessment or they're needing care for depression, anxiety, or they need to explore gender with therapists, explore what to what they want to do about it, or get support through the stressors of transition. Unfortunately, we have a dysfunctional system where it is challenging and expensive for people to get the support that they need.
There are people who insist on seeing people for a lot longer than they need to make an assessment also. And
it's a paradox.
Yeah, the idea that 6 months of mental health or whatever, or a year of mental health visits, one a week or two a week, which some providers might even tell you, is required for everyone, is absolutely not true.
No.
There's no onerous requirement in that way. It just depends on where you access the system, what you end up getting required to do, because the standards of
and
care...
And who the provider is.
Right, exactly, because the standards of care aren't asking for that.
Right.
Right, and Standards of Care 7 says, psychotherapy, while recommended, is not required. Standards of Care 8, at least from the chapter where I'm chapter lead, it's just very directly saying mental health assessments do not require psychotherapy. The assessment, care that's given to people who need that care because of, mental health symptoms that they have, just like anyone needs to see a mental health professional, not to fulfill any requirement. And that is said in Standards of Care 7. It will be said even more clearly in Standards of Care 8.
Good.
So there's another aspect to this general rubric. The emphasis tends to be on assessment in preparation for, medical interventions, particularly surgeries. That's always kind of been the big deal. What about verbiage potentially support trying to get a little better coverage for post-operative follow-on mental health support, because we seem to have a gap there.
Yeah, I understand that. We, as an international multidisciplinary medical association, we, WPATH, cannot make recommendations within the standards of care for any particular insurance system. Because if we do, we basically alienate every other insurance system. So we can't talk specifically about the U.S. problems. Hence, in 2008, I wrote a medical necessity statement that was addressed specifically to the United States market that the WPATH board approved. And we can do that sort of thing. And we did it again. We reissued it in 2016, even more, you know, it was twice as long, more precise. But we can do that in a number of areas, a number of regions around the world.
Okay.
And we do that. We do partner with other people in other countries to adapt the standards for their particular
specific
region and their systems. So yeah, the basic standard, it's produced in English. It can't just apply to the United States system.
Right.
So we can't really talk about those kinds of specifics.
Right.
But we do talk about the value of ongoing mental health care for anybody. I mean, people need grief counseling when someone dies in their family. People need all kinds of support in all kinds of ways. And our culture is what's the villain here, not the standards of care.
Well, yeah, I guess what I'm pointing out is my own life experience. I'm be real honest here. Surgery is just, I don't know, squeezing through the eye of the needle. Mm-hmm. It's not the end all. It's actually just kind of the beginning, and there's a lot that goes on following that.
Well, and that's one of the underlying reasons for recommending mental health in preparation for all of this, and not necessarily requiring it, because not everybody needs it. But for those who do, it is true that you cannot know what's going to happen to you
until you get hit by a bus.
That's right.
You don't know what it feels like to get hit by a bus.
That's right. And you, until you've gone under the knife, you don't know what the outcome is going to be, because even if you use the same surgeon as your buddy and your buddy had a great outcome, you may not.
Right.
And that's sort of the luck of the draw.
I think on the question about focus, there was the question originally was about focusing on surgery when we really should be looking at the lifespan. I do think, unfortunately, there was a proposal that I don't think it went through in terms of having an aging chapter.
Which is a problem, No, I agree. We need that still. But there's very little data about that. There's almost no research with respect to aging trans people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we don't really have that much to say about it.
I mean, I think the standard of care has become much more than just the criteria to get hormones and surgery. That's what it was
in
79.
Right.
But over the years, it expanded and expanded, and standards of care 8 really, I think, looks at itself as a compendium of, all recommendations relating to, the care of people who are trans and non-binary, not just during transition, but all of their health care. And I think there'll be much more in terms of recommendations, for example, for internists, in terms of providing ongoing care to people, across the lifespan, whether that's bone densities or, what needs to be monitored over time. I think that there will be more of an emphasis on lifespan issues in standards of care 8.
Good.
Yeah, one of my takeaways from the summit in Oakland was we're getting much better endocrinology data to look at. As a for instance, which does inform an awful lot of what we were just talking about in terms of moving forward and aging and stuff. But let's look at the other side of that spectrum. What are the hot topics in trans healthcare, for good reason and thank goodness, is pediatrics. So can you tell us, is there going to be more that addresses pediatric care in SOC8?
There's going to be a separate chapter for young children, prepubertal children from adolescents. And so there's two chapters with two themes working on the care of children and adolescents. And each themes are much larger and more diverse than the folks who work on Standards of Care 7. And so I think that will be a big change in Standards of Care 8. And also over the last 8 years since Standards of Care 7, the explosion in care for trans kids and some of the changing conceptions about trans kids, early social transition, for example, is much more commonplace now than when Standards of Care 7 was being written. And so I think that there'll be a lot more guidance in terms of the care of young children, as well as more about medical and surgical interventions in adolescents.
So, you know, WPATH issued a statement not too long ago about the concept of rapid onset gender dysphoria, which has been perpetrated by some, mostly, I guess, parents who suddenly their kid comes out to them as trans and they think, oh, it's peer pressure. So I worked on that statement with one of our leading child psychiatrists, and that's a really powerful statement, which is available on our website. And
kids know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's happened is that there has been a backlash to the care of kids, and there are some websites that get some broad readership of people who are opposed to allowing children and adolescents to transition. And the rapid onset gender dysphoria was a made-up diagnosis for a phenomenon that's been going on as long as, you know, we've been aware of trans kids, which is at some point, trans kids put it together that they're trans and come out to their parents. And so this ROGD quote-unquote diagnosis was from a survey just of parents who were readers of the sites that were opposed to trans youth transitioning. And lo and behold, they found that these, you know, parents had negative views on children transitioning. And part of that negative view was this idea of a social contagion that, the people are suddenly declaring they're trans because of peer pressure. And the focus of this ROGD was on people who were assigned female at birth. And the reality is that a lot of those folks, would not come out as trans until adolescence or later in life. And so the idea in this ROGD that a trans person coming out in adolescence means that their trans identity just suddenly happened in adolescence by reading something on the internet, simply not true. It's just lens of a phenomenon that has been going on since there have been trans people, which is that there, you know, comes a day in which the individual trans person puts a name to what they're feeling and, you know, comes out to parents and friends. And that can happen at any time of life.
Yeah, arguably, goodness, you know, I don't know, what, Homo sapiens sapiens? We've been around forever.
Right, and parents have always been surprised by things their teenagers say.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, well, earlier we were talking about the difference. I mean, WPATH is the world. It's international.
Right.
And therefore, it has to address things from that perspective.
Yep.
So I'm aware of what's called the US PATH. Is there a relationship?
USPATH is essentially all the WPATH members who live in the U.S.
Okay.
So there's EPATH for Europe. There's this is also something that, that we instituted when I during my presidency. In order to give the U.S. people a platform to talk about U.S. policy issues, we had to take them out of the whole global platform because everybody else was like, take me off this list. I don't want to hear about this.
I don't want to hear this stuff.
Stop asking me to refer, you know, who I can refer to in Wisconsin. Leave me alone. So yeah. We increased our global membership by isolating the U.S. membership.
It makes perfect sense.
Yes. So, and we now have chapters in, we're looking at potentially starting a chapter in Israel. We're looking at, there's a chapter that has been wanting to start in Brazil. People in South America were very interested when we were there in Buenos Aires. We're very interested in forming a South American or Latin American chapter. We're looking at AsiaPATH. There's CPATH for Canada and ANZPATH for Australia and New Zealand. They are associations that formed locally in their countries, some of whom basically brought WPATH back to those countries and started building organizations in their local area. We're trying to get them to join WPATH and strengthen our numbers, but sometimes, depending on who the leadership is, they think that it means the U.S. is going to run them over. Again, the U.S. is the elephant in the room always, and that can be a problem.
And there is the possibility with USPATH of being able to focus on American issues.
Exactly.
And, mm-hmm. you know, we thought our American issues might have been, you know, improving during the Obama administration, but, you know, now we are facing, a hostile administration. And
yeah, it's a disaster.
And how to,
yes.
how to support our American members specifically through this, adversarial economy.
Right. But it does give the WPATH board, the overarching WPATH board, an opportunity to be more international and global in their concerns. And then, because there's a separate USPATH board that has a representative on the WPATH board. So nothing happens within one of those chapters, or nothing happens as dictated by the WPATH board that isn't approved by the local chapter okay. that's affected. Mm-hmm. So,
Dan, earlier in this conversation, we were talking about how careful you need to be in scripting some of this language. And then, Dan, in Oakland, you were pointing to the fact that there's going to be, I think, literally a whole chapter on language. Or on terminology, mm-hmm. because of the differences in linguistics.
Yep, that's yes. right. Sari Reisner is
but
the,
yes, sir,
the lead on that.
There'll be a chapter on to address the kind of maybe some broader issues that are not specifically related to transition, but are just related to the concepts that people should be aware of.
Cultural context.
Research. Right. Cultural concepts, cross-cultural conceptions, and then also about different communities like non-binary identified people. And so to kind of have in reading standards of care aid to have a better attempt at cultural humility, essentially, for the healthcare provider.
Well stated.
So this is also the first, Centers of Care 8 will be the first edition of the standards that has a chapter devoted to ethics, which I am working on. I am a legal scholar. My PhD is in law.
Ooh.
I'm the 8th person in the world and the first American with a PhD in law specializing in transgender and transsexual issues. Also, the first American trans person and the second trans person ever to be elected president of WPATH.
That's probably a good place for us to start to taper down by my saying what an honor and a privilege it's been to have the two of you for this conversation this evening.
Can I just say something about Dan and what an incredible champion for trans people he has been for 25 years at least?
Yeah.
Yeah. He has been.
For 25 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You deserve that recognition. He has been an incredible advocate for trans people. And he's been an advocate of mine in terms of bringing me up into a more professional context. And I just want to express that in a very public way. Dan, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, James. I appreciate that.
Yeah, so, gentlemen, once again, thank you.
Thank you for having me. And, you know, perhaps Care 8 is out and we can come back.
Yes, absolutely, sir. You're on my list.
That. That's great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both so much for talking with us tonight.
You're very welcome. Sure. Thank you for inviting us.
This has been Trans Positive PDX here on KBOO. We've been speaking with Drs. Dan Karasik and Jameson Green of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Calculated Conversation with David and Ken.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall in Vancouver, Washington. The theme of the 7th annual Juneteenth celebration is Together We Rise. This theme addresses the idea that together we rise above the fray of hatred, despair, and discord. The celebration features a job fair, panels, awards, contests, an art gallery, live entertainment, and more. Again, that's the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd at the Clark College Hanna Hall, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud